Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Russell Napier and Ira Harris. Russell has been an advisor on asset allocation to global investment institutions for over 25 years. He's author of Anatomy of the Bear, Lessons from Wall Street's Four Great Bottoms, and keeper of the Library of Mistakes, a business and financial history library based in Edinburgh. He has founded and runs a course called A Practical History of Financial Markets, and also an online marketplace, ERIC, for the sale of high-quality investment research to institutions. He's chairman of the Midwine International Investment Trust. And Ira is hedge fund manager and a global trader, foreign currencies, commodities, bonds, and equities for over 40 years. He has served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, welcome.
Thank you. This is a great honor and a pleasure. You introduced me to many people, and this is another one in the long line. So I appreciate this opportunity greatly.
Great. And Russell, you have a new book out called The Asian Financial Crisis, 1995 to 1998, Birth of the Age of Debt. What is that about, and what is the key message? What are the findings from the book?
Yeah, so I was part of that crisis, and I was advising institutional investors through that crisis. And it sort of lives in the shadow now of the great financial crisis. And we kind of assume that that's the dominating crisis, and you can learn nothing from any previous one. So this book looks for that one to see if you can find anything useful as a practical investor. And maybe people have read my first book, so it's in the same vein of trying to give practical advice on how you manage money. However, it's on a much bigger vein as well, because the thesis of the book is that this was a tussle or a war between two forms of capitalism. And just for shorthand, you'll call them American capitalism and North Asian capitalism. There was so much more to it than that. But they fought a war. It was concluded at the time that, if you like, American capitalism had won, but it didn't. And the conditions that were set following this created a huge boom in global debt. And that huge boom in global debt is what conditions our future from here as well. And, you know, it's 400 pages, and I've just tried to sum it up in 30 seconds. But if I try to sum it up in 30 seconds, that's what it is. It's a guide to investing for sure. But it's a bigger picture issue on why we are where we are, and hopefully a guide to where we go next as well.
And do you see any parallels or key lessons from that time period that apply to today's financial and economic environment?
Yeah, so the important thing about the Asian financial crisis is it hit a zone of managed exchange rate policies. And I would say very clearly to anybody who's listening to this, that is where you begin your analysis of any financial market. Is it a flexible exchange rate or not? Because if it isn't, it creates a different dynamic, and I think it creates different opportunities. And when I look around, so I would not use this book in any particular way to, say, analyze the boom in SPACs, for instance. I don't think that's what this book is about. But what I would do is look around the world to see if there are any other managed exchange rate policies which are creating vulnerabilities that could easily be revealed. And the answer to my question on that is China, actually. And that will surprise people, given that it's a country with a current account surplus, very large foreign exchange reserves. But I think the lesson and the parallel is what happened in Taiwan in October 1997, and potentially what might happen in China going forward. So there's lots of things in this book about, you know, local stock markets and valuations and interest rates and how all those fit together. But if I'm just trying to just simply isolate one factor today that perhaps feeds into this analysis, it is potentially China.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I find that this is going to be a very interesting conversation, because comparing the situation in Taiwan, of course, that takes us back to the beginning of the Thai baht crisis of July 2nd, 1997, so which unleashed a lot of forces. But I would argue that those forces were actually unleashed when China depreciated its currency on January 1st, 1994, by 50% from when the yuan went from 5.8 to 8.7. I've always believed and discussed with people that that was a response to NAFTA. But that certainly unleashed a massive amount of capacity upon the world, which I know we'll get deeper into it, but which has given the central banks in the developed world a free pass, because the not deflationary forces, but the disinflationary forces that unleashed from all that capacity has allowed them to believe that they've had everything under control by their own wits. And I certainly shy away from giving them that credibility, but I can see where this is going to become a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, I just add that, Ira, that I completely agree with that. And that's, the book starts in 95 and really focuses on the impact that China at the devaluation had in worsening the external accounts of Asia. So we're very much singing from the same hymn sheet. And when we talk about how we got to this age of debt, it's absolutely how central bankers took the wrong messages, completely the wrong messages from this, to deliver us interest rates which were far too low and take us to the age of debt. So we absolutely agree on the ramifications, and that this was started by a Chinese devaluation. I didn't actually get to the bit where I said why Taiwan is important, Taiwan 97 is important for China, but I think it takes us to another Chinese devaluation. So there'd be a certain circularity here. But to me, that's where this ends up. And I shouldn't call it a devaluation. I should just call it a free float. I think in effect, it means a devaluation. But China is a large country which should have an independent monetary policy. And it will have an independent monetary policy. But just at the moment, I think it's being forced into far too tight a monetary policy, as Taiwan was in that period. And therefore, given the need for independence of this nation, maybe need for something even greater than independence, I think we're moving towards a flexible Chinese exchange rate. So there'll be a lovely circular situation there from, as you say, that devaluation in January 94 to another one coming up soon, though actually when that will be, I'm not so sure.
Richard, if I may,
sure.
Because it's a phenomenally interesting discussion where so much of the world takes off. So if that were to take place, and we've had podcasts, by the way, Russell, with and Richard has moderated them with Lacey Hunt and David Rosenberg and Jimmy Bianco. So we've discussed this, but if that's the case, if China were to devalue, I agree with you. If it floats and the currency depreciates, that will, in my mind, unleash phenomenal deflationary forces upon the world. But then we won't see, and I've been in this camp that I think that Michael Pettis's viewpoint that China is going to will attempt to shift to a more domestic-based economy, but with a weaker yuan, I don't think that's going to take place. They'll reassert themselves is a more mercantilistic force. So
we could have a good argument about this then, because this is where I disagree actually. But let me explain why I disagree. This move to a flexible exchange rate will create huge tariffs against China. You remember 94, this was a very small nation. Its devaluation still had a huge impact. But at that stage, it was still mobilizing its resources, its peasants effectively to the production. So there's no way that this move to a flexible exchange rate would not create even higher tariffs against China, number one. And number two, remember the reason why they're doing this. It's to have an independent monetary policy. And they need that because they need, like the rest of us, they need to inflate away our debts. So we would have a China itself, which is much higher in growth, much higher in inflation, and also with much higher tariffs against it. And it would be a very, very clear acceleration in the Cold War, because America would quite rightly go to every single nation in the world and say, you must not devalue in line with China. There would be a temptation if, say, you were Malaysia or Vietnam or even Thailand to devalue in line with China. And that would be entirely unacceptable to the rest of the developed world. So so what I can agree, Ira, is that the first instance will be, oh, my goodness, this is hugely deflationary. And I've no doubt that the markets would absolutely rapidly move to build in deflation, and that is a huge risk for all of us. But I think quite quickly we would come to reevaluate what this move to an independent exchange rate means for China, and we would begin to look much more at an inflation environment. So as you probably know, I'm on the inflation side of the argument, But I do have a lot of sympathy for people who say the Chinese exchange rate will move and we'll have another deflation shock. I think that's right, but I think it'll last only weeks. So there could be a wonderful buying opportunity on, if you like, the pro-inflation plays as we realize what an independent exchange rate actually means.
And you've been...
The discussion, I mean, it's I'm not going to, in my time perspective, it's not quite on the horizon, but I believe that China is a force to be reckoned with. And, of course, that goes back to how are they going to deal with the role of the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. I mean, there's so much to this. And then you throw in with the quote-unquote green movement, and every day grows the possibility of a carbon tax on all types of imports. So if you really wanted to whack China, throw a carbon import tax, and Russell's game is on to me full force immediately.
Russell, in the past, you've been a long-term deflationist. What prompted you to change to inflationist perspective? You know, why and on what basis?
Sure. So I would find myself for many years in the same camp as Lacey Hunt, which was looking at the money multiplier, not at the velocity, but the money multiplier. In other words, the central bank can create as many bank reserves as it wants, and that is the form of money which all central banks create. That's what quantitative easing creates. But that form of money, if it was not utilized by the banks to allow them to extend their balance sheets, then we didn't create the form of money which impacts GDP. And there's obviously a very long argument in that, but that simplistically was the deflationary argument. And there would not be a money multiplier. There would not be high levels of broad money growth. And therefore, there would not be high levels of or rising levels of inflation. And one could look at the system today and say, well, don't we have the same system? And I think what changed was really last March, April, the governments really stumbled in an emergency upon a way to get the money multiplier working. And that is obviously by guaranteeing loans from banks. And we had this explosion in bank credit growth. And I know I get emails every day from people telling me that it stopped, but it hasn't stopped. And this is really important. Bank loan growth is clearly rolled over. Bank loan growth is anemic, but bank credit growth is still strong. And the difference between bank loan growth and bank credit growth is their holding of securities. So bank balance sheets are growing quite nicely. If they should begin to flag, by the way, I'm sure we'll see more government guarantees coming in. You know, Iris mentioned the carbon tax, but it's so easy to see that we will see subsidized loans going out for all forms of green investment, all forms of leveling up investment, all forms of bank loans to help younger people. So to me, Richard, what happened last March is that governments realized that they can create money. They don't actually need central bankers to create money. If they guarantee the loans of the banking system and the banking system extends loans, then just as it's been doing since the 17th century, the banking system is creating money. Now, there's a name for this. It's the kind of system we ran after World War II. And it's a way you control money supply by the governments controlling commercial bank balance sheets, not central banks controlling the price of money, nor the size of their balance sheets. So I see that as being a revolution. And we can debate how far different countries have gone in that revolution. And it may be that there's a little bit of pushback against them. But ultimately, this is a magic money tree for the state. This is off-balance sheet finance for the state. They will continue to pursue it in pursuit of political goals, which are some of the ones I mentioned, green, perhaps more equality. And that means much, much more money in the economy. And it's the money we use and is measured for GDP. So that's where I changed my mind. I believe there's a structural revolution in the way money is created, one we tried to abandon in the late 1970s because it was so disastrous, but it's back.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
I'm going to, you know, listening to you, Russell, when you start talking about a magic money tree, your Scottish accent comes more forward. So I understand historically that that's the case, because we know there's no magic money tree, although there's those who would like to believe it. But it takes us to, last week when the Fed, and I'm glad we're going to get into this, or we've walked into this, I think probably through the back, but when the Fed announced that standing repo facility, and the size of it, $500 billion ceiling and a $60 billion for foreign institutions or entities. I'm not sure what qualifies, whether it's just Europeans, I'm sorry, the central banks that they have already established swap lines with, or it goes beyond that. But does that, because you bring up post-World War II, which I think we would agree was, whether it's Operation Twist or just the classic yield curve control, which I think they're going to have to get back to anyway. But when I keep looking at the standing repo facility, I view that as a backdoor approach to establishing yield curve control. And so we're almost there. In fact, one of the better plumbers, my favorite plumber is James Aiken. I don't know whether you know him.
I know James, yeah.
Yeah, so James, I know James pretty well. James taught me a lot. But Zoltan Pozsar called it a stroke of genius. And I think that's probably why, because it guarantees that liquidity structure and a bid to sovereign debt. So if you're holding 30-year treasuries, you love this because you now have a place to dump it. And someone said, well, it's only for a day. Yeah, but I can keep rolling that over because they've guaranteed that they're going to have this facility there and they can actually expand it a little bit if they need be. So it ensures me a bid. But I think that we have walked through the back door to yield curve control, which the Fed seemed to pull back from last year. In fact, it's exactly a year because Lael Brainard gave three speeches about the way to do yield curve control or the benefits of it. And then all of a sudden at Jackson Hole 2020, all yield curve control discussions seemed to stop in all Fed communications. So I have to agree with you. I think that's where they're going to have to go.
Yeah, I'm glad I disagreed with you on China, because otherwise we might end up agreeing on everything. But I certainly agree on this. And I guess many people listening to this will not. It seems easy, yield curve control. And this is a really, really important bit. It just seems like, well, that's something we put in place. And now let's go back to business. You have to understand just how distortionary yield curve control is. And the first thing you have to say is a central bank pursuing yield curve control is not an independent central bank, full stop. And if you don't believe me, then read about the 1942 to 51 period. Read Friedman and Schwartz on it. Read the Federal Reserve on it. They were not an independent central bank. The supply of money was controlled by the government when you set yield curve control, not by the central bank. The central bank provides whatever liquidity is necessary to keep yields at the right level. Aaron, the only thing I wanted to add to what you said is that it is such a dangerous policy that it will have to change. Now, I don't mean that they'll have to abandon yield curve control. Let's be absolutely clear on that. But there comes a time when you cannot continue to use the central bank balance sheet for this, because as you've pointed out, huge amounts of liquidity are created and they will ultimately be inflationary. But there is another way you can control the yield curve without using the central bank balance sheet, which is to force savings institutions to buy these government bonds and force a yield cap through financial regulation. Let's call it, and they will call it, macroprudential regulation. And you stuff savers full of really bad investments under the fig leaf of regulation. So why this is important is, as long as the central banks are onto yield curve control, I think you stay long equities. I think equities are a clear beneficiary of this stupidity. But when the time comes that inflation is really getting out of control and they have to go to phase two, which is forcing savings institutions to buy the government bonds, well, those institutions have to sell something to buy something. And the main asset they have to buy is going to be equity. So it's not on the horizon. If pursued in isolation by the central bank alone, so I think the time will come when they'll have to pass the baton on to the regulator. And, I've got lots of advice for investors, but don't have your money in a regulated financial institution, because it is going to be forced to buy government bonds at really shockingly high prices.
I'm so glad we've got, you're right, and that was outstanding. And I try to have this discussion with people, and that's why I believe that Brainard is going to be appointed, because Secretary Yellen certainly is aware of what is going to have to take place. I don't see a way around it. I think this standing repo facility was a beginning, but the numbers that we're talking about are so vast. And I agree, you know, having read my Friedman and Schwartz, but Meltzer's history of the Federal Reserve on this is phenomenal, as is, to me, Carmen Reinhart's work on the financial repression of that period from certainly from 44 to 51. So I think those are must reads for people who are involved in this. But I want to get here with you, because the role of the dollar's role as a reserve currency, and this we've never seen. You know, the Brits had their issues, and of course, Churchill, you know, trying to bring back Britain onto the gold standard in 25 created all kinds of problems. But to me, this is why the Fed can't move, because the dollar, if the dollar were to rally, the world would absolutely crater into that deflationary cycle that people are predicting, because the dollar, there's just too much debt denominating the dollar around the world from countries that would really be hard pressed and would have to unload all types of stuff onto the world market at whatever prices to raise the dollars to pay for it. And we actually saw we saw this with what went on when the Swiss pulled the peg in 2015, and all those loans, all those mortgages that were made in Eastern European countries by stupid Western European banks who pushed Swiss denominated loans because the rates were so low. I mean, those lawsuits are still going on. And I think the Fed has to be very cognizant. And that's why I believe they have to get the yield curve control, because yield curve control will be the thing that keeps the dollar weak. And I think the global system, because of the reserve status and the huge amount of dollar debt, needs a weak dollar, not a strong dollar.
Yeah, so I agree with that. I would just add in it to further emphasize it. They also need a pretty stable treasury market as well. These treasury securities have become the security, the backing for many loans. They are the collateral for loans. And of course, in a world where they've lived in for 40 years, where the price of collateral only goes up, and that's really what's been happening to the price of treasuries for 40 years, you have a borrowing system. Now, just think of houses. Remember 2007, there was a system where the price of the collateral could only go up, so you would lend more. Imagine living in a world, and this is really financial markets, hedge funds, where the value of the collateral, suddenly we think it can begin to come down. So there's no way that and yield curve control is about propping up the price of a security. That's what it's about. So there are two ways in which that works. I would add swap lines. You know, writing a book on Asia, with the benefit of hindsight, having lived there, I do wonder what would have happened in Asia had the swap lines from the Federal Reserve been in place the way they are today. And, you know, as an American citizen, I would love to ask my central bank why they think it is absolutely essential to lend hundreds of billions of dollars to other central bankers who hold hundreds of billions of dollars. Korea would be the prime example of that. But I think, Ara, you've hit the nail on the head as to absolutely why they do that, and it's to stop a rise in the dollar. It's to try and manage the exchange rate. So this is a horrible situation they've got themselves into. But the swap lines are another way that they can try. And, you know, if there's a real shortage of dollars in the world, there's a scramble for dollars and the dollar goes up. The swap lines are relatively new as a financial historian way of stopping that. But let's not forget the need to stop any decline in the price of treasuries, to hold up this collateral value as well and stop this debt mountain from collapsing. A collapsing debt mountain is a deflationary outcome. And it's pretty clear to me, I think most people, that the socially acceptable way to deal with debt is an inflationary outcome. And that's why the price of treasuries will not decline. For those of people who are listening to this and saying, oh my goodness, that's the end of the dollar, of course it isn't, because everybody else is doing exactly the same thing. It's not. This is not an American problem. This is a global problem. So the Europeans will be doing it, the British will be doing it, the Australians, Canadians, they'll all be in the same place. So it's not, hey, this is a demise of the United States dollar story, because everybody finds themselves, the entire developed world, not the emerging world, and the Chinese find themselves in the same situation.
You know, Richard, unless you got something, this is absolutely phenomenal, because when I tell people, you know, people, if you tell people that you're bullish on gold. You know, of course, you know, you always get put in a gold bug camp, which is such a pejorative phrase. But I said, you know, because I'll go, oh, you're a gold bug. And I'll turn around and I'm not a gold bug. Me, I, you know, Richard and I, we've talked about this for so many times. And I, Peter Bookbinder, I would rather see gold at $42 because it would be a signal that all is good, all is well. It's as good as the world could be. But that's not, and of course, now that we're into Bretton Woods 50th anniversary, the end of Bretton Woods, I should say 50th anniversary, that I would love to see gold. But that's not happening because, again, to me, gold just represents the credibility of central banks. And I believe that Paul Volcker would tell you the same thing, because when central banks lose their credibility, it's not necessarily inflation. Inflation is the great boogeyman, but it's central bank credibility. And central bank credibility has been it's been fragile. Well, you know, I can go back to the end of Bretton Woods, of course, Arthur Burns' role, and we can go on and on and on. But it's that credibility that is called in question. So it's gold versus the fiat currencies. I think you're absolutely right and to phrase it that way. It's not the dollar, because everybody has followed the Fed down the rabbit hole. Bernanke laid the groundwork for it, and everybody followed. And Lagarde at the last ECB meeting, at the press conference, you could tell it was she was angry, because it was not a comfortable meeting, as we found out after the fact. And you can talk about consensus all you want, but she was under the gun from the Hanseatic Five, so to speak. And she laid it out. She said, look, we can't move off of asset purchases because of the large amount of debt, which I mean, this is a tautology if you've ever seen one. The large amount of debt taken on by households and firms makes the financial system fragile. And because of that fragility, we can't begin to end it. And I thought that was the most honest anybody's been. And I thought that was representative of her frustration. But to me, that put the Fed in a difficult spot, because the Fed, if they move first, the dollar is going to soar. And then,
so I'm glad you mentioned Paul Volcker, because I knew Paul Volcker a bit. So I maybe see him just once a year. But I remember the very first time I met him, which was, I think, 2002. And it's in the book, which is why I mention it. And I said to him after his presentation, after my presentation, where did it go wrong? And this is what he said. He just gave me four letters, LTCM. And in the book, I point out, so it wasn't that LTCM was bailed out. It's not the first institution that was bailed out or the last. And by bailed out, I mean, it didn't default on its creditors. Its equity holders took a reasonable hit. The point was that monetary policy changed because of LTCM. Here was a financial institution for which the man who ran the central bank changed monetary policy because of its behavior, because of its exceptional behavior. And of course, we'd already seen this after the crash in Mexico, that lots of investors or speculators, call them what you will, had also been bailed out. These weren't banks getting bailed out. LTCM wasn't a bank. The people who invested in Tessabonos in 1994 weren't a bank. So I didn't have a long conversation with Paul Volcker on that, but LTCM. So that's when it started to go wrong. And of course, if you constantly bail out people who take debt, guess what happens? You get more debt. So I link that LTCM event in this book to what it is called, Birth of the Age of Debt. And you are right. There is only one socially, politically acceptable way to get rid of debt, and it is inflation. That is the only way. I mean, there are other ways you can do it, but none of them are socially or politically acceptable. And the central banks, they may not tell us that ostensibly, but it's there in every word that drips from their mouths that they're going to inflate this stuff away. And financial repression, which we've touched on, I once did a presentation to some old age pensioners, and they said to me, look, you've used that term, but you never really understood, you never really explained what it is. And I had to think on my feet and come up with an explanation for it. And I said, it's stealing money from old people slowly. That's what financial repression is. That is the only plan they have. We're now living through it. I mean, I hope the book is some help in how you cope with that. But we're not living through it for a year or 2 years or three or five or 10 or, You know, this is a 15 to 20 year story, and it's taking money from savers and giving it to debtors. There's no doubt. I mean, I've been forecasting things for 25 years. Sometimes you forecast with a high degree of confidence. Sometimes you forecast with a low degree of confidence. But that inflation will be used to move wealth from savers to debtors, I think we can have an incredibly high degree of faith in that, because the alternative is kind of socioeconomic collapse.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know what? Here's the amazing thing. Although two weeks ago, he actually wrote a column pushing it. But when Rogoff wrote that book, This Time It's Different, with Reinhardt, one of his ways out of the debt overhang, of course, was 4 to 6% inflation. Like, you can control that. Even Volcker laughed about that, even, you know, to the day he died. They picked these numbers. Oh, it's 1.92. The difference. Yes. You know, only an economist playing with numbers can laud that difference. But Rogoff talks about running 4 to 6%. His words, not mine, 4 to 6% inflation for 3 years, 4 years. We could live with that. And that'll do a lot to alleviate the debt overhang. So to say otherwise is absolutely to challenge your credibility. Hence why gold continues to hold up, because it's not because of inflation. It's because of central bank credibility. And as I like to laugh about it, these are all frustrated physicists who unfortunately have gained control of banking with no sense of real economic history. And so they think they're rocket scientists, except that they don't understand that a rocket scientist can actually bring the rocket ship back to where you can pick it up in a very small circumference. And they have no way of bringing their policies to an end.
I teach financial history, so I'm glad you brought that up, because one of my series of lectures is 21 Lessons from Financial History. And the last one is never trust a forecast with a decimal point. And the follow-up is never trust a forecast at a decimal point, particularly if it's your own, because what it means is you're deluding yourself. You know, it's fine to look at somebody else's forecast with a decimal point and sort of accept that they're deluding themselves. But if you put one in yourself, then you're completely gone. You're completely deluding yourself. The 4 to 6% inflation number is a number that I have in my mind for what we're looking at. So I'm not looking at hyperinflation. But what I would say is this. There's a very good book on this by Peter Bernholtz, Inflation and Monetary Regimes, and you'll know this, Sire. There's a certain level of inflation at which velocity begins to change. And we've lived in a world where velocity has been stable to falling for really a very long time. And we've come to accept that that is the norm. But of course, it's the norm in a period of disinflation. And there is a level of inflation at which velocity goes up. And for anybody listening, you know, for any lay people listening, just means that basically you lose faith in other forms of saving and you begin to buy stuff rather than save, because you think the stuff will hold its value better. So the classic example from Weimar Germany is grand pianos. People bought grand pianos because they would hold their value better than bank deposits. And that was when the money that you would be saving suddenly is turning over in the real economy and you get more inflation. So the problem I have with the target, and I think they have all basically come to this target, though they won't tell us, and not for 3 years, believe me, for longer, is that at some stage, that level of inflation is going to trigger a jump in velocity. And at that stage, you get spikes in inflation to higher levels. And here's the bottom line. There isn't a central banker in the world who's got the guts to deal with that, full stop. Not one. What made Volcker special? Was it that he was smarter than everybody else? No, that he was prepared to give harsh medicine when harsh medicine was necessary. And there are no central bankers today who will do that. So that's, you know, when I talk about there being more inflation, it's also the lack of spine in central bankers that brings you to this conclusion, that there is no way they're going to inflict that sort of pain on people. You might say that's a good thing, depending on your political opinion. But Volcker was pilloried for his opinions and pilloried for what he did. And we'll have to wait a long time before there is public support for someone to do a Volcker. And in the meantime, wealth seeps away from anybody in fixed interest securities or deposits, and it seeps away to the benefit of those who have debt.
Yeah, well, that is, yeah. And what Volcker taught, you see, the lesson that they learned from Volcker, and it may be the right lesson, is that central banking is asymmetric. But Schumpeter had told us that back in the 30s when he discussed the concept of pushing on a string. Central banking is asymmetric. You can stop the whole concept of pushing on a string. When I read Schumpeter's essays, which I have, he's my favorite economist for many reasons. It's my old Marxist sense too, sorry. Is that when you go down that road, I can stop inflation by raising rates. And that's what Volcker proved. I can stop it. I can bring the economy to its knees and end it. But as Bernanke has spent his life pursuing, which I call him a 37er, because 1937 was such a critical year for his work, is, and Japan has showed them this, is it's very hard to end deflation, even though the United States, we have not been in deflation since the 30s. So that's a misnomer. And they'll say, well, we needed to prevent it. But Schumpeter told you, you can take interest rates to zero, but if the economy is running negative, you can't get anybody to borrow. An entrepreneur will not borrow if they can't get a return on the money that they borrowed. And this is what central banking reflects. So that's why they always tell you, well, we know how to stop inflation. We have the tools. We have the tools. But I think, Russell, you say it so well. They just don't have the backbone to put those tools into place. And you can tell, by the way, this is the Greenspan legacy, which is you raise interest rates by 0.25%. But when you need to cut them, you can cut them by 150 basis points. There's the asymmetric nature of their thought process. And I think it really creates major imbalances in the global economy.
What I used to say, Ara, about what was the definition of a central banker? The definition of a central banker was a man or a woman who would permit inflation in anything except wages. That was the old definition of a central banker. Today, the central bank definition of a central banker is someone who will permit inflation in anything. That's the change, because they're actually saying that they're targeting wages, and not just wages, but inequality of wages. You know, we've got a central bank which is unelected, which is suddenly going to fix the global environment, it's going to fix the global economy, it's going to fix wealth inequality. Nobody voted for them. I don't have a problem with people voting for those things and voting in democratically elected governments to derive these things. But this is the Wizard of Oz. I mean, the central banker is a little man or woman playing an organ behind a great big curtain. And they do not have the power or the democratic legitimacy to suddenly start targeting all the things that they have unilaterally decided that is theirs to target.
Yeah, you're so right. And the fact that they are unelected and they've taken this upon themselves. But, of course, the worst phrase uttered in the last decade was Chuck Schumer telling Bernanke, you're the only game in town, because they took it seriously. And then everybody else followed suit. What Draghi did. And I understand preserving the euro as long as the elites had the political will to preserve the euro. But at the cost was tremendous. And I don't think you're out of the politics of it, because we have German elections coming up September 26th. These will be interesting because to me, the Germans are the most financially repressed people in the world right now by design. But this has been the outcome of Draghi and Sarkozy. And I believe, you know, when I'm really nasty, I use a different phrase for it, but I believe they dragged Merkel into the woods and really blindsided her. She had no idea what they were doing. Some tried to warn her, but Germany is in a very, very critical place. I think the ECB has gone so far that there's really no way out of it. Yeah. Because if you really want to see a global deflation, have the Germans pull out and watch what happens to European debt, then you have a real problem. So
I think the Europeans are effectively doing yield curve control already, which is probably why the U.S. Yield is doing so well. I mean, a lot of people have to, big global bond funds have to choose between the euro and America, and I'm sure there are significant flows into U.S. bonds simply because they're trying to escape what is effectively yield curve control. Already going on the way in Europe. We must remember that you know, I've written my previous book looked at that period in 1949, and that was a period of yield curve control. It's funny, when I speak to investors today, they'll say, well, you know, okay, so they can hold the treasury yield down, but we'll always be able to get a good yield on corporate bonds. So, well, that's absolutely not true because, you know, there's an arbitrage here. And if you're only getting 2.5, as it was in those days, on treasuries, then people bid up the price of corporate or bid down the yield. And it's only 3.5 on corporate. And that could still be 200 basis points below inflation. And if the Europeans are, as you say, I think you're right, involved in yield curve control, it would play a significant role in holding down the United States Treasury yield below inflation as well. So the ultimate destination here is restrictions on the free movement of capital. But while we still have the free movement of capital, that European monetary policy is, in my opinion, having an effect on U.S. long-term interest rates. People listening to this will perhaps think we're two cranks, but there is a very good book by a center. So just to prove that it's not just us who worries about this, Paul Tucker was the deputy governor of the Bank of England. He's written an excellent book called Unelected Power, and where he looks exactly at what he calls overmighty citizens. And obviously, given his background, he's looking at central bankers. Our central bankers are overmighty citizens. And, you know, these overmighty citizens have got a very clear goal. And let me say it again. It is to move your savings to the relief of debtors. That is their goal. And it's not absolutely explicitly spelled out, but that's what's going on here. And, you know, no one told them to do it. No one elected them to do it. But my goodness, they're determined to do it.
Yeah, well, you know, because, again, and it's Carmen Reinhart's great work on financial repression, and people don't want to, but you just laid it out so beautifully. Financial repression is a policy. And the policy, and as any policy, whether it's tax policy, whether you have to look who's getting screwed, because every policy screws somebody. You know, ultimately, may be very good, but somebody's going to pay the piper. As Russell Long, Senator Russell Long, who was the head of the Senate Finance Committee for so many years, used to say, you know, all the lobbyists would come to him. So he created a little ditty, which is don't tax him and don't tax me, tax the person behind the tree. And that's, you know, that says everything you want to know about budget and tax policy in the United States. Now you just have to find out who's the one who's behind the tree. And right now, as you say, it's the elderly, and they can justify it because the elderly in America have dipped deep into Medicare and Social Security, and that wasn't always funded by them, by the way. I've had this discussion even with my dear father, may he rest in peace, about means testing as to what he should get. And, of course, as Dan Rostenkowski, who was the head of the Ways and Means in Congress for so many years, learned, it's a very dangerous path to walk down. But somebody's going to pay.
Well, let me give you another quote on American fiscal policy, which is an 18th century quote from a man called Alexis de Tocqueville. And he said, the American Republic will endure until the day Congress discovers that it can bribe the public with the public's money.
Yeah.
I don't know if that time has come or not, but I hope it hasn't, because I do hope the American Republic endures. As to what you should do about this as an investor, there's some very simple lessons. Don't own bonds. And if you find yourself with an investment manager who's, because you're older, I mean, this is the bizarre thing. I mean, if you go to a financial regulator, the financial regulator will tell your manager that the older you are, the more bonds you have to hold. Bonds are a certificate of confiscation. That's what we call them in the United Kingdom from 45 to 78. That's what they are again. Do own equities, in my opinion. You might differ, Ira. I'll be interested to hear your opinion on that. And, you know, until we get to the stage where we have to force savings institutions to buy government bonds. And of course, I agree with you on the yellow metal as well, and probably on residential property in certain parts of the United States as well. So there are things you can do to help mitigate this. But remember, the saver loses and the debtor wins. And when you're investing in equities, to some extent, you can play the other side of that, because there are corporations who have borrowed a lot of money and probably now borrowed it very cheap and locked it in. So you have to be careful about what sort of equities you're buying. But there are ways we can mitigate this. But in the last great financial repression, there was really only one place to be, and that was gold.
You know, Russ, I agree. It took me a lot of years to understand, because, you know, having read, you know, Irving Fisher, who's I'm sure you're a fan of too, and that he was long the stock market. You know, there are a lot of people who I viewed with great intelligence, except Keynes was probably the best investor of them all. Stocks, and I felt this way last year when the world was melting down and we were staring into the abyss before they went on to open up swap lines. And I will say this, I write a blog, Notes from Underground, in homage to the great Dostoevsky and his view towards rationalists, is the same for rationalists, I should say. And I, 3 weeks before the Fed did it, I said, what are you sitting here? I'm watching the dollar rally and prices are, and all this debt and people are rushing to raise cash. You need to open up swap lines and you better make them available. And 3 weeks later they did. So I was glad. But I'm like you, history gives you these lessons. And when you're on a dollar standard, and actually I give Richard Clare to, credit, because the papers he did in late 2019 and of course into the COVID crisis called for the importance of the U.S. because of its reserve currency status, that it has to act as a central banker to the world. Now he seems to forget it of late, but that's okay. It was an important part to play and it took the pressure off the dollar. And then of course Feibel did his pivot away from fiscal austerity in May of 2020, but these were all very, very important things. And the role of the dollar does play this out here. But I think you're right.
I think the interesting point is you mentioned some of the smartest people in the world who still don't get this right. That's how difficult it is. And even Keynes himself, before 1932, actually had a pretty bad record as an investor. From 32 onwards, was a spectacular investor because basically he became a value investor. And there were a lot of very few things around in 32. I mean, famously, he was measuring up the crypt for King's College, Cambridge, to try and store grain in it because he was having to take delivery of some grain that he speculated on and the price had gone to low. But I think the smartest person who ever lived probably was Sir Isaac Newton. And you will know that Newton once said, I can calculate the motion of heavenly bodies, but not the madness of people. So we have to remember that this is not necessarily a fully rational sport. The madness of people plays its role. It's a difficult business, and you know, even for professionals, it's a difficult business. It's a treacherous business for amateurs.
I believe it was that great Scotsman McKay who wrote the Madness of Crowds. Sits on my desk because
I'll send you a new copy of that because I've written the foreword to the new copy. So
is that right?
Yeah, it sounds like all I'm doing here is plugging books all the time, but just in case anybody hasn't got a copy, copy out.
That's right. But I think that equities, and last year in May and June, I did two of these podcasts with Richard and Louis Gavet, and we had that same view. If you buy certain stocks because you're buying assets, because we saw what was going to come, it's not necessarily reflation, but all the things that were unloved, the value stocks, mines, you know, we loved Freeport, Glencore, agricultural firms, because they were unloved because everybody was convinced, well, this is the end of everything, but no, it wasn't, and they performed very well. So I think if you find firms, corporations that know how to manage their assets and what they do well, those are good places to hide out in anticipation of financial repression and money destruction. I took me a long time to get there, but I think that is absolutely, we learned that I think in Zimbabwe and Argentina. You know, you look at places where stock markets and you go, the economy is terrible. Yes, but companies there that can manage well through this are really, you're just buying high quality assets. And especially if they pay a dividend, which last year's theme was, they have to still pay a dividend through all this, become very good forms of investment.
Yeah, well, we agree on that. The beautiful thing about a corporation is it's run by management. And sometimes you have smart management who can change, and they can change quickly. And I think if COVID showed us anything, is that the best management in the world can change things quickly. And the asset you were investing in one day, which may have looked doomed in a world of COVID and lockdown, suddenly due to the engineering cleverness and industriousness of management turned around. Now, not all management are like that, but that's the beauty of the equity, is that you have the right equity, has the right management that can cope with change. Whereas that bond, I'm afraid, that gives you a fixed coupon forever, and it's not very well equipped to cope with change, and particularly inflation.
Okay. I know we're coming to the end, but because Russ, I read enough things that you write and seek you out. So let's, we opened with China. Oh, Richard, I'm supplanting your role, but I have an opportunity to ask a question. So
go ahead. Yeah.
So if China went to a central bank digital currency, do you, in order to gain credibility with it, and this is totally a hypothetical, would you think that they would have to back it somewhat with precious metals?
Yeah. So my answer to that would be yes, because I don't think it has credibility without it. And you might say, well, why does the dollar have credibility without it? Well, what the dollar has that China does not have and cannot have is a rule of law. And I realize there'll be some Americans listening to this who'll think, well, we don't really have a rule of law. But look, it's better than China's. The ability to protect your property rights against the government in America is still high, maybe not as high as it used to be, and it is non-existent in China. So it doesn't matter whether China has a paper currency or a digital currency. The bottom line is, can you enforce your rights against the government? Now, if there was some backing on this, and if that gold was in a place where people were convinced they could get hold of it, that would be a way for China to perhaps to begin to create a currency that could rival the dollar. But I think the real problem would be physically, where would the gold be? Because if it was physically in China, I think there'd still be question marks to people as to whether they could ever go and retrieve it. And anywhere outside China, it is subject to the long arm of America. So, I think you're right that is probably the only way they could do it. But I think that's going to be difficult for them as well. The threat to the dollar has been, in my opinion, is massively overdone. It's massively overdone by people who think it can be China, but it's just massively overdone. This is not a competition for the most beautiful girl in the room. This is a competition for the least ugly girl in the room. And that is still the dollar. Yeah. Sorry for being sexist on that. I should say the least ugly person in the room. So.
Yeah. Yes, no, I agree. But, you know, when I raise this issue with people, the Chinese, they have a long, and it's not a racist thing to say, this is the Chinese view of the world, is much more long term. And I said, nothing would be more karmic than to have a Chinese digital currency backed by silver to undo all the work of the Brits and the and the opium wars. And I said, what a statement that would be upon the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, so we're speaking from the same end book, and I will have to drop off soon. But I think that's like the problem will always be, where would that silver be? Where would that gold be? So you and I were convinced that we would be able to remove it and stick it in our pockets or our bank vaults or whatever. And that's a big problem they'd have to get over.
Yeah, that's great. This has been a wonderful experience for me. Thank you for allowing me.
Yeah, fascinating discussion. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Russell?
Well, my work is available only to professional investors or high net worth individuals because of the regulations. So easy way to do that is to put in russellnapier.co.uk and suddenly you'll be there. I run a course in finance, which within 6 weeks we should have available on video. It'll be about 20 hours long, the practical history of financial markets. And I've got the books, Anatomy of the Bear, the Asian Financial Crisis. I don't want to bore everybody, but that's where if you're interested in subscribing or learning more, you can see the bias. The bias is the belief in history. The bias is the belief that money and credit are important and that there is more to life than a decimal point.
Great. And Ira?
Notes from Underground and on these FRA podcasts and the It is such a, Richard, Financial Repression Authority is absolutely that should be where everybody goes. Okay. Because, yeah, I mean, it's just, as Russell points out, that's the times in which you live in. And if you're being financially repressed all over, if you own a bond, the only thing you can hope for is more government intervention to take them off your hands, as you see in Europe on a daily basis, because when the ECB comes in, you know, I can look right now, and if I tell you the 10-year bond is a negative 45 basis points. Well, the only way you can ever make money is if somebody comes to buy it to lift the price. Otherwise, you're in the throes to it. So we are living in the age of financial repression. How it all plays out, I don't know. As again, to quote Louis Gavet, my clients pay me not to forecast, but to adapt. And adapt we shall do.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Russell and Ira.
All right. And if Richard, if you could send me Russell's contact, I'll send him an email. I'd love to be able to go back and forth with you.
Thanks,
guys. Ira, it'd be great. Great to be in touch. Thanks. I'm feeling I have to dive off. I've got to go and catch a bus.
Okay.
Russell, can I ask you one question?
Sure.
Do you know Bernard Connolly?
No, I don't. I mean, I recognize the name. Why do I recognize the name, Ira? Because I don't know him, though.
Well, he was on the he had a big role. He was very close with Mervyn King, but he was on the team that put together the EU. And then he left and wrote a book called The Rotten Heart of Europe.
That's it. That's why I know him, The Rotten Heart of Europe. But I don't know him. We have mutual friends, but I definitely don't know him.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm kind of surprised. He's actually a good friend of mine. It was another person and I who brought the book. It was out of print and was selling for $400 or $500 on Amazon. So we printed 10,000 copies of paperback, and he wrote a new foreword in 2012 to distribute it. Because Bernard has taught me so much. I mean,
we didn't get into the euro, but in my opinion, it ends with capital controls intra-euro.
Yeah, I don't know any other way, because now the Germans are in so deep, they can't get out.
Yeah, so intra-euro capital controls, which over a long period of time becomes obvious that they're actually separate currencies and not one currency. So not a spectacular split up with everybody moving in different directions.
Yeah.
Capital controls, different levels of inflation, and a recognition that those controls can never be lifted.
I know you got to go. This was absolutely wonderful. Maybe we'll do another, if we can do another one at your pleasure.
Yeah.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks, Richard. Thanks for
talking. Okay, thanks, Russell. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.